You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article...
For centuries, philosophers, not Gerald Ford, but philosophers, theologians, psychologists, and writers have debated the concepts of good and evil, the construct of morality, and how these ideas and notions fit together and add up to make us human. The philosopher John Locke popularized the idea that humans enter the world with a blank slate, a tabula rasa, and that our sense of morality develops over time based on our environment and experience. In his latest book from Crown, called Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, Paul Bloom argues the opposite. He says we enter the world with a hardwired sense of morality, that babies and infants are able to feel empathy, compassion, and even hostility toward others. Mr. Bloom is the Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Psychology at Yale University. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me on.
Don't most of the world's religions have stories about the struggle between good and evil?
They do. And some people would say that what we're discovering in our scientific studies kind of matches up with some of what the world's religions say, which is that, you know, humans are a battlefield of good and evil. We have good desires and positive desires, moral desires, mixed in with a bit of original sin.
Of course, today people think more in terms of grays than black and white.
Well, when you get to the combination of our good impulses and bad impulses, things get complicated. And it's difficult to point to sort of unadulterated evil or pure distilled good. They're always rather complex when you look at them closely.
Unless you're talking about politics in Washington. In recent years, has the discussion shifted somewhat from the philosophers and theologians into scientific research?
I think this is a very interesting time to study morality. And by now we have powerful methods to start to look at how morality develops in babies and young children, which is what I study, how it's represented in the brain, how it's enacted in social context. I think we combine this with evolutionary theory and also with a lot of philosophy.
Well, let's talk about the research behind the conclusions you make in this book. How much is based on your own work? How much on the work of others?
The book is actually mostly a review of research done all around the world in many different labs. I start off in the first chapter talking about research I've done in collaboration with my wife, Karen Nguyen, the Yale Baby Lab, and talking about our findings that even young babies can tell good guys from bad guys. They want to reward good guys. They want to punish bad guys. But the scope is broad. A lot of people are studying this.
And are they mostly psychologists? You're also called a cognitive scientist. Is cognitive science a branch of psychology?
Cognitive science is often viewed as sort of an umbrella category that includes psychology, but also neuroscience, computer science, and also philosophy. So a lot of our work, I don't see this as opposed to philosophical investigations, as opposed to sort of bringing them in on it and working together with them.
How long have you been doing these studies and how many have you done?
Oh, gosh. I've been studying morality for as long as I could remember. But the collaboration with my wife studying baby morality, probably mostly over the last 5 years. And I don't know how many studies we've done or how many hundreds of babies we've tested.
When you say babies, what age range are we talking about?
Well, we've tested babies as young as 3 months of age.
Is there a difference between an infant and a baby?
No, I use the term kind of interchangeably.
So for 3 months until we start talking?
We do. When people sort of view the end of infanthood, the end of babyhood is when they start talking. But I've studied kids until they're ready to leave for college. I mean, we've done research on 4-year-olds and 7-year-olds, and we do some research with adults as well.
And when you study people throughout their life, do they remain fairly consistent? Or is there the tabula rasa aspect?
I think what we find is that there's a built-in morality, a moral sense in babies. But it's tragically limited to start with. It's babies are naturally cold-blooded to strangers. They're very prone to distinguish us versus them. And some of this, of course, persists through adulthood. But what happens in many societies for many people is that we use our intelligence and our culture to transcend us. So you were better as a 5-year-old than you were as a 2-year-old, and you're almost certainly a better person now than when you were a 5-year-old.
I'd like to believe that anyway. Well, since they don't talk and their brains are not fully formed, aren't babies and infants notoriously difficult to study? How would you describe a typical research experiment that is conducted with a 3-month or a 4-month old?
Well, in some of our work, what we do is we show babies one-act plays. So imagine a character struggling to make his way up a hill, and then another character gently helps it up, while a third character shoves it down. Now, you can't ask babies who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. But what you can do with, say, a 6-month-old is hold out the character that helped and then on one side and a character that hindered on the other side and see who babies prefer to reach for. With slightly older babies, you could see who they prefer to give a treat to, reward, or see who they want to punish by taking something away. You could see what they think of other characters who punish and reward these different characters. And what we find, as young as we can test, is that babies prefer the good guy over the bad guy. They prefer to reward the good guy. They punish the bad guy. And they like people who reward the good guy and punish the bad guy.
When you say they tend to, are you talking about every baby?
You never, ever in these studies ever get
100%. So should I be afraid of the baby who rewards the bad guy?
Yeah, we often wonder about that. There's always, say, 15%, 10% of babies who don't, who like the bad guy, who choose the bad guy, who like to punish the good guy. And so the question is, you know, are these sort of pint-sized psychopaths? Or are these just babies who aren't paying attention for our study? And it's actually something we're trying to study by seeing whether the same babies who choose the bad guy in one experiment will then go on to choose the bad guy in another.
Well, these are pretty simple morality plays. Do you ever get into issues like guilt and shame?
We try – other labs are trying to study them. And typically, you don't get much data on this before children hit about their first birthday. But then there's some nice work on guilt and shame. So it was a classic study, for instance, where an adult leaves a kid with an attractive toy and says, look, I want to leave the room. Under no circumstances, touch this toy. Do not touch this toy. Do not play with this toy. So the kid's being taped and watched. And, of course, when the adult leaves the room, the kid reaches for the toy and starts playing with the toy. Then the adult walks in. And what children do is they blush, they get embarrassed, they start to justify themselves if they could speak, and they look exactly as you and I would look if we were caught doing something we didn't want to be caught doing.
So they know that they did something wrong.
They know that they did something wrong. And the emotion they feel is not anger, it's not fear, it's embarrassment. It seems to be guilt and shame.
My guest is Paul Bloom, whose latest book is Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Well, studies of morality of babies, nothing new. They've been going on I'm thinking now of Kenneth and Mamie Clark's study from the 1940s. And they looked at black children, black babies, and also by giving them dolls, black and white dolls.
Right. So you're talking about what may be the most influential developmental studies ever done, because these studies were part of the grounds for the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that ended up desegregating America's schools. So psychologists have long been interested in babies and young children, and particularly certain aspects that are morally related, including race and in-group versus out-group and what they think of other people. And we find some interesting things.
Well, since the babies in the Clark study, the black babies, tended to choose white dolls, would that suggest that that was hardwired? Or were they already learning issues of racism at a very early age?
Well, these were, if I remember right, sort of 4- and 5-year-olds. And there's been a lot of studies with younger kids. And one of the good news, aspects of good news that's come out from this research is racism doesn't appear to be hardwired. So you take a 3-year-old white kid. The white kid isn't going to prefer to play with another white kid than a black kid. He isn't going to show any preference or so on. Other things are. So, for instance, if you take a baby or a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old and you expose it to two people and one of them is an American baby, one of them speaks English, the other one speaks French, the kids are going to go for the one who speaks English. They're going to prefer that one.
If they've been hearing English
exactly,
up until that time.
Exactly. What if one of them speaks English, the other one speaks English with a faint accent? They'll go for the one who speaks without an accent. So a bias on that has to do with language seems to show up as early as you can test it. A bias based on familiarity as early as you can test it. But skin color, the relevance of skin color appears to be something which you have to learn.
You mentioned the 1954 Robbers Cave study. What was significant about that one?
Oh, this was a wonderful study looking at – these were somewhat older kids, and they were brought into a camp and separated into two cabins. And what happened was, and they were this was an experiment designed to look at sort of hatred towards other groups. The kids very quickly developed a loyalty to their own group and a hatred towards the other group. And the psychologist running the show tried to make this hatred go away in all sorts of ways. It was meant to sort of be an experiment. Can you instill world peace? They had them have meals together, but they turned into food fights. They had them, they had peace negotiations, but then the kids turned on the other kids who were negotiating. What finally brought the kids together was a common problem, a common enemy. The kids were told that somebody cut the water pipe to the camp, and then all the kids from these two groups got together and tried to solve the problem.
I wonder if that kind of thing could be applied to the problems of the Middle East, for example.
Well, nothing puts people together like a common enemy. Right now, the Republicans and Democrats are more polarized than ever. But you look historically at times when they haven't been polarized. These are times when we're at war.
Mm-hmm. Well, do studies like that relate in any way to your work with infants?
They do. Some work that Karen is doing, for instance, finds that just like adults, infants will seize upon the slightest difference to fall into one group and compare to another group. So you have a study, for instance, where babies see two puppets, and one puppet likes graham crackers, and the other puppet likes green beans. And the kids have their own preference, typically the crackers over the green beans. And then they have to respond to the puppets. And if this seemingly trivial difference isn't trivial at all in the minds of the kids. They prefer the puppet who likes the same food that they like. And in fact, they often like to see the other puppet punished.
So choosing from between right and wrong also involves doling out punishment?
It does. And in fact, the question is, when we did our baby studies, an immediate question comes up. Well, you're looking at preferences. But how do we know it's moral? One signature quality of morality for adults is if you see something which you think is wrong, you don't just say, I don't want to do it, I don't like it. You say, I want those people punished. And this was the motivation for looking at punishment on behalf of young children and babies.
Do babies cry out to point out an injustice? Do they cry?
Babies and young children's dominant mode of communication with adults regarding other babies and young children is tattling, is pointing out things. There was one study that found that, in middle school kids and elementary school kids, the number one reason they'd ever talk to an adult or a teacher is to complain about another kid's immorality. And they wouldn't lie. The kids who would lie would be the kids caught doing the bad thing. They would say, I didn't do it. But tattling appears to be sort of a fundamental part of human nature.
Well, how early does this start? If you have a bunch of babies together and one kid starts stealing all the food, do the other kids, they can't talk, but do they still wind up revealing that?
It's a good question. We've actually never studied that in young babies. It's sort of, I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how one would. But what I would bet is that if one kid started making trouble and being bad, the other kids would avoid that kid, and more than that, would be pleased if that kid was punished.
Well, most people agree today that there's both nature and nurture lead us to become the people we are. When does nurture start kicking in?
I think it starts kicking in at the get-go. I think it starts kicking in before the child is born with the sort of nutrients the child gets in the womb. And then it goes right through. So you're right. When you look at, we're mostly interested in our research in what all humans share. But of course, everybody's interested in how we're different, how your morality differs from mine, how a psychopath's morality differs from both of ours. And it plainly there's genetic influences. But there's also an effect of parenting and of culture and society. And these happen, this influence arises at the earliest age you look at.
And psychopaths and sociopaths, that's something that develops later, or are there clues as to the way somebody might develop later in life?
Children, even babies, differ in their temperament and in how much the pain of others bothers them. And I think to some extent psychopathy has a genetic setup, but then it's exaggerated and intensified by how one's brought up.
My guest is Paul Bloom, Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Psychology at Yale University and author or editor of six books, The most recent, Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, it is published by Crown. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Paul Bloom, his latest book, Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, from Crown. When identical twins go through all of these tests, do they generally respond exactly the same?
Identical twins are very similar when you test them on different things, and as you'd expect, because they're genetic clones. And typically, you know, except for those extreme cases where they're raised apart, typically they have pretty much the same environment. What's kind of interesting, though, is, and what's always surprised behavioral geneticists and a lot of psychologists, is how different twins can be when they grow up and how different people, siblings in the same family, can turn out. You'd expect them to be pretty identical. They have the nurture, they have the nature. And one thing I think, and some people have proposed, is if you're living in the same family with someone else, there are forces that pull you apart. The firstborn, for instance, might take the dominant niche. Might be, if the parents are athletic, he'll be athletic. If the parents are scholarly, she'll be scholarly. And then the secondborn comes in and has to do something different. Maybe it'll be the comedian. Maybe it'll be the rebel. And so being raised in the same family, you want to find your same space. And this might be a force that pushes people apart.
But we even see it in more extreme cases. I've interviewed a journalist, a very respected journalist, whose older brother, in fact, two older siblings, had been criminals. And one of them wound up being the subject of a book by Norman Mailer before he was executed. So
there's the Bulger brothers in Boston.
Well, there's the Bulger brothers, one who becomes a politician, the other one who becomes one of the most powerful criminals in American history. So you have to wonder how that kind of thing can happen in the same family. Is it, again, genes, just the fact that one of them was hardwired a little differently?
It could be, but I actually think we tend, when we ask how do people turn out the way they do, we tend to talk a lot about genes, and we know genes have an effect. And we tend to talk a lot about how they're raised and their families, and we know that has an effect. But what also has an effect is random events, crazy things that are idiosyncratic, somebody getting mugged, somebody coming in first in a race, somebody falling in love at the right time or the wrong time, that could change your destiny.
What role do traits like empathy and compassion play in our moral makeup? And how do babies exhibit qualities of empathy, for example?
So humans are empathetic from the very start. When your typical baby, when he or she sees somebody in pain or hears somebody cry, it's upsetting. It's painful. You feel other people's pain. And this is, I think, to some extent, a catalyst for morality. If I see you in pain and it bothers me, I'm motivated to help you. And there's tons of laboratory evidence that finds that when you make people empathetic towards another person, you motivate them to help. On the other hand, I'm somewhat skeptical of people who say that empathy is sort of the core of morality. A lot of times the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, doesn't involve being empathetic. It could involve overriding your empathy.
Do we ever see depravity in infants?
I think you see cruelty. In babies and young children. I'm not sure. I've always wondered whether there's ever a force of evil for its own sake, doing bad for the sake of being bad, or what we see as evil is just other appetites overwhelming your sense of good.
Nobody wrote about the way Marquis de Sade was when he was an infant, unfortunately, so we won't know. You talk about disgust in the book. What does it have to do with issues of morality?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it shouldn't have to do with morality. I think disgust often plays a role in moral debates, particularly with regard to sexuality, where many people say this sex act or this sexual behavior proclivity is wrong because it's gross. It grosses me out, and I think it's wrong. And it's often used as an argument, and many people find it persuasive. But I think one reason to dismiss it is disgust has had an extraordinarily ugly history. Many of the people now find, homosexual marriage to be disgusting. But certainly 50 years ago, many people found interracial marriage to be disgusting.
Well, you cite psychologist Paul Rosen and his work with children and food. And children express a lot of disgust over certain foods.
They do. Rosen's work is wonderful. And what he finds is that there's a certain period, say roughly 4 and 5, where disgust starts to emerge. with kids. And then kids are often hypersensitive. They don't want to have two foods touch each other on a plate. The words gross and yuck come in powerfully. But younger than that, and I think it's because the neural systems just had – the brain hasn't wired up yet. Kids are often entirely disgust sensitive. So Rosin did this clever experiment where he gave kids peanut butter mixed with cheese and told them it was dog feces. And most of the kids said, I'll eat it. Or they'll agree to eat a grasshopper or something. Then, boom, at a later point, the kids become hypersensitive and they wouldn't go near anything like that.
Where does Freud's construct of id, ego, and superego fit into all of this? Does it make any sense today?
I'm a fan of a lot of Freud's work, and I think Freud's deepest insight was a powerful role of the unconscious in determining our attitudes and beliefs. But I think Freud got morality wrong. Freud believed that we start off with an id, nothing but an appetite, wanting it all.
I want.
And then only later, as a result of socialization, do we develop a moralizing superego, saying, well, this is good and this is bad and so on. But the research done in our lab and the research done elsewhere suggests that Freud was just mistaken. The youngest babies you could look at have a conscience. They have a sense of right and wrong.
Well, we tend to associate the development of reason with much of this. When does reason kick in? Or is it always there as well?
Reason is a gradual process. It emerges gradually. I don't think babies deliberate over their moral decisions. Babies certainly don't debate them and discuss them. And this is, I think, one of the ways in which we transcend our initial limited morality. We could argue about morality. You could say, well, I think so-and-so is wrong, and I could say, I disagree, and we could go back and forth. And minds are changed. There was a time when everybody thought slavery was a perfectly moral institution. Now we know that that was mistaken, and I think reason is to be credited for that.
My guest is Paul Bloom. His latest book, Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Not everyone agrees with you. Some people question your interpretations of your research findings. While babies may be drawn to nice guys and repelled by mean guys, they say it doesn't necessarily represent some moral code in the DNA.
I think they're right to be skeptical. When we came out with our first finding showing babies prefer the good guys and the bad guys, people said, well, maybe there's something else about your experiment you haven't attended to. Maybe you're overinterpreting the results. And I think those are perfectly reasonable objections. The response to them is you do more and more and more studies. So what we've done by now is we've done dozens of studies using very different methods, and they all seem to converge on the same thing.
Well, in science, other people then have to duplicate your findings. Other people have been duplicating your research?
Other people, there's been direct replications of our research at University of British Columbia and elsewhere. And there's also been some wonderful work using similar methods but asking slightly different questions. So we look at helping and hindering. Other researchers look at fairness and unfairness. And they find similarly, kids are to some extent outraged at people who are unfair to others, and they like people who are fair to others.
A listener, Rich from Manhattan, asks, to what extent do these characteristics weigh in for adults, as they sound very much like what adults can be dealing with?
I think that everything we find in babies, we could find in adults. I think if we brought you to the baby lab and we sat you down on a high chair and we showed you the same things, you'd reach for the good guy. You'd want to punish the bad guy. I think none of this goes away.
Although I've developed a sense of irony, so I might very well not do the predictable thing just to have some fun.
You asked before whether it's difficult to study babies. One way it's easy to study babies is babies lack a sense of irony. So you test five-year-olds, they'll often do the wrong thing just because they think it's funny. Hmm. And college undergraduates are just doing it for beer money. So their motivation is suspect.
You say that Thomas Jefferson and Adam Smith were two people who favored the view that humans are born with innate senses of right and wrong.
Our research supports a long tradition, which has become unfashionable, I think, recently. But people like Jefferson and Smith had a lot of respect, a lot of evidence, a lot of arguments for the idea there's a moral sense. Jefferson talked about an innate moral sense that whose strength differs from person to person, just as the strength of arms and legs differ from person to person, but every normal person has them.
So was he aware of what John Locke had written?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure of his philosophical background. My sense, having read about Jefferson, was he was very philosophically sophisticated. So his views on morality were grounded in the best thinking of the philosophers of his time.
Another listener, Cindy from Brooklyn, is wondering if gender roles are learned or inborn. I'm sure you've studied that.
I think the answer to that is yes, they are learned and they are inborn. In our studies, we don't actually find sex differences. Boys show the same responses as girls. I think because our studies present moral dilemmas, which are just so natural and easy for babies that everybody gets them. Other research, though, finds that girls tend to be somewhat more empathetic than boys, somewhat less aggressive.
Very early?
Very early. Some studies, even in the womb, boys will kick more, but we call that aggression. But certainly later on, boys are far more likely to be violent, and boys seem to be upset less at the suffering of others. But at the same time, though, I think it's pretty clear that these roles could be very much exaggerated by a society you live in or diminished.
And we read all sorts of things into the exterior aspects of this. For example, I remember an ex-husband who sued his wife for putting their son in pink because he said he was she was creating a homosexual child. And, of course, royalty used to – boys used to wear pink, and nobody thought twice about it. Color, obviously, would not affect the kid. But we read all sorts of stuff into – what's going on with children, don't we?
There's a wonderful picture. I think it's FDR as a boy dressed in this beautiful dress, looking kind of grumpy. And your sense of how to dress kids has changed over time. And it's why when you talk about sex differences, you have to be careful because you read into something differently when it's a boy versus when it's a girl. So some studies have been done where you take the same baby and you put the baby in blue versus putting the baby in pink. And you find when the baby's in pink, its movements are seen as softer and more delicate. Blue, it's more aggressive. So when you make claims about boys being more aggressive than girls and less empathetic, which I think are true, you need to be very careful that your own biases don't color how you interpret their behavior.
Dow from Brooklyn asked a question I had meant to ask, but we just wound up going in another direction. What definition of morality is being used in this discussion?
Well, it's very hard to define morality. There's no agreement on what morality means, even for adults. So I relate it to a cluster of things, judgments of good and evil, certain emotions. You talked about guilt. There's guilt, there's righteous anger, there's shame, there's empathy, a desire to reward some things and punish other things. A cluster of behaviors that is actually critically important to our lives. We make moral decisions all the time.
You mentioned earlier that major developments in the areas of neuroscience and evolutionary theory have had an impact on this kind of work. In what way?
Well, regarding evolution, it was once believed in sort of a simple-minded evolutionary way that evolution is the survival of the fittest or nature red in tooth and claw. So then morality, kindness to others, would be a mystery, and it seems to involve God or involve something separate from evolution. We now know through sort of sophisticated evolutionary thinking that some degree of kindness towards others in some limited and interesting ways could well be a biological adaptation because of the way genes work, because of how organisms prosper when they cooperate. And regarding neuroscience, we now have pretty powerful methods that could discover what part of the brain is active when you make different moral judgments and use these methods to figure out what parts of morality fall together and what parts are very different.
In the Brothers Karamazov, maybe some other works from that time, the discussion involved whether a belief in religion affected one's sense of morality. The feeling is that if you didn't have religion, then if you were an atheist, then you didn't have any need to be good, to be kind to others.
Without God, all is permitted. A lot of Americans believe that. Americans are far – you ask Americans, would you vote for a Muslim to be president or a gay person? And they say, yeah, maybe not, maybe. But you ask them, would you vote for an atheist? A bare majority or sometimes most people say, no, I wouldn't because they can't be trusted. The evidence suggests that that's mistaken. The evidence suggests that there's complicated relationships between whether you're religious or not and your morality. But – you know, consider that the most atheistic countries in the world, the Scandinavian countries, are also the sweetest. People murder each other less. They rape each other less. They love their neighbor. So any simple claim that you need religion to be good is just flat wrong.
You mentioned at the start that you've been doing research into a sense of right and wrong for much of your career. What got you started thinking along these lines?
I've always been interested in my own moral views and the moral views around me. I've always been saying, so why do I think this is right? Why do others have such strong feelings about gay marriage and abortion? And where do my feelings come from? And then I had kids, and I watched their own moral views develop, sometimes in surprising ways. They're teenagers, and they certainly don't agree with me on everything. And
we think that we can program them to some degree, don't we?
I think people have this optimistic view, which lasts just about until they turn about 3 or 4 or 5, and you realize that they're their own people. And to me, it's a fascinating question where our moral views come from. It's always been fascinating. And I also think it matters. I think it matters because we want to know which of our moral opinions we should trust and which ones we shouldn't. And I think psychologists have something to weigh in on that matter.
Paul Bloom is the author of a number of books. I said 6, or editor, including the highly acclaimed How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like, articles for the New York Times, the Nature, Slate, The Atlantic, New Yorker, among other publications. And his latest book is called Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. It's published by Crown. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much for having me here.